Let's go ahead and open our Bibles to 1 Kings chapter number 20. We're going to start at verse 43 in just one moment. I shared with you last time that chronologically, I think we are able to backdate from the death year of King Ahab to the year of the Syrian invasion of northern Israel. So I think his death year is 863 BC, and that would put his invasion year in 866 BC. Now, God told Ahab through a prophet that if he would just trust him, he would save him from this Syrian invasion. And that's exactly what happened in 866 during that first invasion. But he was also warned to get ready that they would be back the next year, the next spring. And they did. I think in 865 BC, they came back again. And God gives them supernatural assistance once more. Unfortunately, to the shame of King Ahab, he does not capture and execute King Ben-Hadad II. He treats him as a respected peer and even releases him as part of an agreement to make an alliance between the two nations, between the northern Israelis and at least the Damascan Syrians, the ones that are directly under Ben-Hadad. And so God sent a prophet to King Ahab with an object lesson. This prophet had been punched in the face by another prophet at God's command and was bleeding and had bandaged up his face and covered his eyes somewhat, made him look different than he really normally looked. And so he went to King Ahab and said, "Hey, King Ahab, you got to help me out. I'm a soldier, and I was given a POW and warned to keep him safe and secure on pain of death, and he got away. Save me, help me." And King Ahab's basic response was, "No, you deserve what you get. You let a condemned prisoner of war get away." And that's when the prophet took off his bandage, and the king recognized him as one of the prophets. And the prophet said, "You're the guy. You're the one that God gave a prisoner of war to that should have been executed, King Ben-Hadad. And you didn't do it. You let him get away. You made a deal with him. Well, your life is forfeit because of that." And so I ended in last session with this being the beginning of the end for King Ahab. And he knows that. And it doesn't make him happy. So 1 Kings 20:43 says, "The king of Israel went to his house vexed and sullen and came to Samaria." So he leaves the meeting place where he was at up by Aphek, and he's really irritated by the whole thing. And so he comes back to Samaria, back to his kingdom, and he just kind of pouts for a while. And eventually, he must go back to Jezreel. I shared with you, I think Jezreel was his favorite place to hang out. It was a beautiful city with a nice overlook of the plain of Jezreel and the valley of, the plain of Megiddo on one side and the valley of Jezreel on the other. And it had some beautiful gardens attached to it, near it. And that's where the next story takes place. And I think this is more than likely happening probably the year before his death, something in that neighborhood. Certainly not more than 18 months before his death. Chapter 21. Now, Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard in Jezreel beside the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. So all we know about Naboth comes from this story. He was native to the region. His family's property, going all the way back to the time of Joshua, was located right here at the city of Jezreel. And so he has a long time established, we're talking about hundreds of years, established family vineyard. And it's right next to Ahab's palace. Verse 2, after this, Ahab said to Naboth, give me your vineyard that I may have it for a vegetable garden, because it's near my house, and I'll give you a better vineyard for it, or if it seems good to you, I'll give you its value in money. Now, this by itself is perfectly fine. This is acceptable. He offers to exchange Naboth's vineyard for some other vineyard elsewhere, because he'd like to have this piece of property as a place to have a garden for his palace kitchens. And if he's not interested in money, or if he's not interested in exchange, he says, I'll just pay you whatever the value is that you put on it. And this was all perfectly acceptable. He could not exactly sell it, but he could lease it to him until the next year of Jubilee, or until a certain date. But Naboth is not interested in that. Verse 3, but Naboth said to Ahab, he who is forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers. So he says, no, sir, I am not going to let you have my family property. It's been in my family for centuries. And so Ahab went into his house vexed and sullen. Same sort of phrase that we found after he'd been told that his death was on its way. He went into his house vexed and sullen because of what Naboth the Jezreelite had said to him, for he had said, I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers. And he lay down in his bed and he turned his face away and he would eat no food. So he basically pouts. He pouts because he can't get this piece of property next to his palace for his own little kitchen garden spot. Now, that's bad enough. But what happens next is much, much worse. Jezebel, his wife, remember, the princess of Sidon, the troublemaker who has really pushed the worship of Baal and Ashtoreth, who has tried to eradicate the true faith from northern Israel, but didn't get that done because of the supernatural activity of God through prophets like Elijah. And you'll notice that the faith, the true faith, is being practiced out in the open now because of the work of Elijah. But Jezebel, his wife, came and said to him, why is your spirit so vexed that you eat no food? So what's the problem? How come you're not having any meals? And he said to her, it's because I spoke to Naboth, the Jezreelite, and said to him, give me your vineyard for money, or else if it please you, I'll give you another vineyard for it. And he answered, I'm not going to give you my vineyard. So that he says, I'm pouting because I can't have my way. I can't have what I want. And Jezebel, his wife, said to him, do you now govern Israel? So she is a little bit dismissive of him. And this, I think, fits the thing we've talked about before. She is the stronger personality in this relationship. So, are you or are you not the king of Israel? Arise, eat bread, let your heart be cheerful. I'll give you the vineyard of Naboth, the Jezreelite. So she says, I'll take care of it. So here's how she takes care of it. She wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal. So she's basically governing. And she sent the letters to the elders and the leaders who lived with Naboth in his city. That is, here in the city of Jezreel. So she writes official documents to the leaders governing the local city. She wrote in the letters, you need to proclaim a fast and set Naboth at the head of the people. and set two worthless men opposite him. Two, because such charges require two or more witnesses. Set two worthless men opposite him and let them bring a charge against him, saying, "You've cursed God and the king," and then take him out and stone him to death. So their instructions from the king, it would appear, is you need to proclaim a public day of fasting in the city, a day of great sadness, of difficulty. And when you assemble everybody, you need to tell them that the reason for this fast day is because Naboth has cursed God, that is, he who is, and King Ahab. And both of those are punishable by death. To blaspheme God and to blaspheme the king, both are capital offenses. And so once you present the fake evidence, because that's what it's going to be, then carry out the required penalty. You take him out and you stone him to death. So verse 11, the men of his city, the elders and the leaders who lived in his city, did as Jezebel had sent word to them, as it was written in the letters that she'd sent to them. They proclaimed a fast, set Naboth at the head of the people. The two worthless men came in and sat opposite him. And the worthless men brought a charge against Naboth in the presence of the people, saying, "Naboth cursed God and the king." So they took him outside the city and stoned him to death with stones. Now that speaks to the sinfulness of the leadership in this city. They are more like Ahab and Jezebel than anybody else. They are willing to do whatever they're told to do in order to get to the result that the king wants. And so Naboth has just been murdered using the government system in a twisted fashion. And then once it was finished, they reported back to Jezebel. Then they sent to Jezebel saying, "Naboth has been stoned, he's dead." So it's done, it's finished. As soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, Jezebel said to Ahab, "Arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money, for Naboth is not alive, but dead. So you can go and confiscate the property now, because the man is dead, and his property is open for sale to whoever wants to buy it." And obviously, the king's purchase request is going to take priority over everybody else. As soon as Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, Ahab arose to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it. So the deed is done, the land has been seized, and Ahab is down there making plans as to, you know, how he's going to rip out, you know, most of the vines and put in this vegetable over there and that vegetable over there and this fruit tree here. So he's down there making plans for renovation. Doesn't seem to be a bit bothered by how he just got the property. All that matters to him is he got it. Verse 17. Then the word of he who is came to Elijah the Tishbite. So now we come back to the big name prophet. We've had several unnamed prophets doing things with Ahab, but now we bring in the big guns again, saying, "Arise, go down to meet Ahab, king of Israel, who is in Samaria, because he is in the vineyard of Naboth, where he's gone to take possession." Now, this is one of the places I want you to take note of this, that by this time in the writing, the northern kingdom of Israel, at least a large portion of it, is referred to by the term Samaria. So the Samaria here is not the city of Samaria, but rather the region of Samaria. Because we know for a fact that Naboth's vineyard is in the city of Jezreel, which is a good day's travel away from the city of Samaria. So Elijah is told, you need to meet the king at the vineyard of Naboth and give him a message for me. So the two of them are there at the same time. You shall say to him, thus says he who is, have you killed and also taken possession? And you shall say to them, to him, thus says he who is, in the place where dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, shall dogs lick up your own blood. So Naboth was apparently executed in his own vineyard, which has now become the property of Ahab. And the scavenger dogs were in there licking up Naboth's blood. And apparently, in a few more months, you know, a year and a half maybe, some of those same dogs are going to be licking up Ahab's blood. So Ahab said to Elijah, have you found me, O my enemy? So that's the way he greets him. He doesn't like him. He answered, oh, I have found you, because you've sold yourself to do what is evil in the sight of he who is. Behold, I will bring disaster upon you. I will utterly burn you up. I will cut off from Ahab every male, bond or free in Israel. I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. That's the first dynasty. Gone. When it came to an end, all of the members of it were killed off. And like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah, same thing. That's the second dynasty of the northern kingdom of Israel. When it came to its end, it came to an utter end. All members of the household destroyed, both dead-ended. For the anger to which you've provoked me and because you made Israel to sin. Now that's a reference to the Baal and Ashtoreth worship. So God is basically saying the Ahab dynasty is also going to dead end in northern Israel. Now some of it is going to spread down into southern Judah and last for a little bit longer, but not too much longer. Verse 23, here comes the prophecies. And of Jezebel, he who is also said, the dogs shall eat Jezebel within the walls of Jezreel. And anyone belonging to Ahab who dies in the city, the dogs shall eat. And anyone who dies in the open country, the birds of the heavens shall eat. That same curse, you will remember, was put on the family of Jeroboam and on the family of Baasha. Verse 25. There, this is a commentary, I think, from the prophet that's doing this section of 1 Kings. There was none who sold himself to do what was evil in the sight of he who is like Ahab, whom Jezebel his wife incited. Another reason why I tell you repeatedly, she was the stronger personality in this relationship. She pushed him to do all these wicked things, but he agreed. He agreed to do them. And that makes him evil and wicked. He acted very abominably in going after idols, as the Amorites had done, whom he who is cast out before the people of Israel. And that's always a reminder that the reason northern Israel ends up going into exile is because they sinned just as bad, and in some cases worse than the Canaanites that they dispossessed at the beginning of their history in the Promised Land. Now, Ahab hears this prophecy that he's going to be dead soon, and the same dogs are going to lick up his blood that licked up Naboth's blood, that his wife Jezebel is going to be actually eaten by the dogs, that all his family members are going to either be eaten by scavenger dogs or scavenger birds. And this bothers him. There is somewhere in him a little bit of a soft spot, which God tried to work with, but never was able to break through his free will to do sin. When Ahab heard these words, He tore his clothes and put sackcloth in his flesh, and he fasted and he lay in sackcloth and went about dejectedly. So he feels bad right now about what he's been told, about why he's in trouble and what's going to happen because of that trouble. So momentarily he is, we're going to use this word very carefully, repentant. So for just one moment, he kind of changes his attitude, changes his mind. And that gives him a little bit more time. Verse 28. The word of He Who Is came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, "Have you seen how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he's humbled himself before me, I will not bring the disaster in his days, but in his son's days I will bring the disaster upon his house." So God says, "All right, Elijah, you see all this happening right now? I'm going to postpone some of the judgment for a little bit longer until after he's dead. Then I'm going to bring the judgment on them, on all of Israel." Now, chapter 22 kind of goes back to the idea of what happened after Israel defeated the Arameans, the Syrians. Chapter 22 says, "For 3 years, Syria and Israel continued without war." So, 865, 864, 863. No fights between the two opposing sides. 863 is where we're at when verse 2 happens. In the third year, Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, came down to the king of Israel. Now, we actually have the parallel coming back into the story here from 2 Chronicles 18 at this point. 2 Chronicles 18, verse 2. Well, let me read verse 1 again. "Now Jehoshaphat had great riches and honor, and he made a marriage alliance with Ahab." Remember, we talked about Jehoram ends up being married to Princess Athaliah. The goal seems to have been that the child, the male heir born from that couple, will have a right to both thrones, and that the breach between northern Israel and southern Judah can be healed in this family. So verse number 2 of 2 Chronicles 18 says, "After some years..." So after many years of this alliance between the two nations and the marriage that is kind of binding them together, he, meaning Jehoshaphat, went down to Ahab in Samaria. And Ahab killed an abundance of sheep and oxen for him and for the people who were with him. And then he induced him to go up against Ramoth Gilead. Now I want to return to the 1 Kings 22 passage. So Jehoshaphat comes for, shall we say, a family visit to meet with the father-in-law of his son and his partner of the Israeli people and his partner in trying to bring the two nations back together. And the first thing that Ahab does is let him know, "I've got a problem that you can help me with." 1 Kings 22:3. "The king of Israel said to his servants," so this is kind of in the public gathering with King Jehoshaphat right there, "Do you not know that Ramoth Gilead belongs to us? And we keep quiet and do not take it out of the hand, of the king of Syria." So they've just won several victories against the invading Syrian army. And now he brings up the fact that, hey, you know what? We actually own the city of Ramoth Gilead, which is on the east side of the Jordan River. It's quite a few miles to the east of the Jordan River. And apparently the Syrians of Damascus have pushed southward through what we call the Golan today into that same region. And Ramoth-Gilead is the southern anchor of that bubble of possession that the northern kingdom of Damascus has control of. And so he says, you know what? They're holding on to a piece of property that belongs to us. Why should we let that happen? Verse 4, he said to Jehoshaphat, will you go with me to battle at Ramoth-Gilead? So will you, as my partner to the south, as a fellow Israeli, as the father-in-law of my daughter, Athaliah, will you join me in freeing the promised land from the Damascus Syrians? And Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses. So his knee-jerk reaction is, I'm on your side. Let's go to war. When we come back next week, we'll discover that he rethinks that maybe he should check in with God before he makes such an agreement.